The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, on today's show, we'll be talking about Germany, Japan, and their militaries. Actually, we'll focus more on Germany. There's a piece at National Review. It's a two-part series that in the first part discusses Germany and its military, and as we go through it, we'll get into that in the second segment. But as we go through that, you'll see that so many of the comments and quotes that are in that article are things that we've been covering, particularly in the last several months, over the past year, in fact. Also on today's show, we'll update you on some exciting statistics about God's work in this part of the world. Specifically, here in the UK, we ran the repeat program. Our best performing repeat here in the UK over the weekend that advertised Mystery of the Ages, and it pulled in another strong response after we've repeated that show, I think, for the fifth time now. So that's coming up later on in the program as well. But first, we begin with President Obama's farewell address given in front of a loyalist crowd last night in his hometown of Chicago.
By almost every measure, America is a better, stronger place than it was when we started.
That's President Obama deciding to deliver his farewell address in Chicago instead of in the Oval Office. And of course, what he said there, in fact, quite the opposite is true. You can look into the Great Again book. I'll have some excerpts from that here in this first segment in just a bit. But suffice it to say, by every measure, America is weaker and more divided than it was 8 years ago. And certainly, there are more sins. I mean, we're just becoming sin-drenched in American society. And that's weakening the nation. That's weakening America's standing in the world. And then you look at all of the division. And yet, as we've covered in recent weeks, this administration is out there taking its victory lap and convinced that everything's better. Here's a little bit more from what he said last night, clip two.
If I had told you 8 years ago that America would reverse a great recession, reboot our auto industry, and unleash the longest stretch of job creation in our history, if I had told you that we would open up a new chapter with the Cuban people, shut down Iran's nuclear weapons program without firing a shot, take out the mastermind of 9/11, if I had told you that we would win marriage equality and secure the right to health insurance for another 20 million of our fellow citizens, if I had told y'all that, you might have said our sights were set a little too high.
And of course, when you look at his agenda and rattle through that list as he just did there, you have to say that he's been quite successful in radically transforming the United States of America. But the thing is, all of those accomplishments have not made America stronger. It's not put America in a better position. It's much, much weaker, as I said just a moment ago. When reading the transcript of that speech this morning, I thought of this Spectator piece about how, I forget who wrote it, but he was explaining just how the liberal elites can come up with such ridiculous conclusions. How do you explain the idiocy, as he says, in the title of his piece at the Spectator? And he goes through a number of points. One of them is that what the elite Really, the whole focus of the piece is that they've been educated in our modern system of education. And he then says what the elite have been led to believe is that governments make things better. And over these past 8 years, of course, the size of America's government has expanded massively. It's so much bigger. It's so much more intrusive. As my father makes the point in the Great Again booklet, I mean, even as we're in retreat abroad in the United States, even as we're pulling out and downsizing, when you look at it militarily or when you look at America's influence abroad, you have at the same time this government at home that's amassing all of this power. And that's what's been happening these past 8 years. And for people that have been educated in this kind of left-wing thinking, well, they look upon these past 8 years as a tremendous success. But then you see the divide. You have the liberal elites on the one side and those coming through our modern system of education. And, of course, then those that have risen up in protest, Donald Trump supporters. Not that all of them are uneducated by any means, but as this piece brings out at the Spectator, the ordinary people, as it calls them, they rely more on what they see for themselves and experience. And he makes the point that they're subject to some of the same indoctrination that the liberal elites are, but maybe just not as much. But then he says this is in The Spectator from January 7th, let's try to understand why members of the elite get so cross when others don't take the same view of Brexit and Hillary Clinton as they do. It's partly a sense of entitlement. People talk of a culture of entitlement among those who live on benefits, but the elite has its own entitlement culture. They think that because they studied English literature at Durham, they understand the world better than the plumber in Croydon. They think they are superior, and therefore their view should prevail. They also think they are morally superior because they hold to the views which they were told were virtuous. It says, finally, anyone who appears not to subscribe to these views must of necessity be a sinner or else appallingly misled by the Daily Mail or some other evil force. It's outrageous to the elite that the work of the devil should prevail. They're virtuous. They know best. They're the chosen ones. They have only a token belief in democracy. They expect and intend to prevail. And so they continue on pushing with the agenda, pushing the agenda. They're a little bit down, but not out. Certainly the Democrats have taken a beating when you look across the United States. But as Great Again brings out, I mean, the damage that's been done, that book, I mean, that's the follow-up to America Under Attack, and both of those, I don't have the stats on the second one, Great Again, but as you know from a couple of years ago, America Under Attack was our most popular booklet. And this one, no doubt, is going to follow right in that same course. Going back to what the president had to say last night about all of the progress, he made sure to point out that in these areas, we haven't made quite enough progress. This is clip 3.
But for all the real progress that we've made, we know it's not enough. Our economy doesn't work as well or grow as fast when a few prosper at the expense of a growing middle class and ladders for folks who want to get into the middle class. That's the economic argument, but stark inequality is also corrosive to our democratic idea.
And going back to that Spectator piece, here again, the education of liberal elites, they've been taught that bigger government makes things better. And then following that point, he says they've been taught that capitalism is inherently bad. That's what they believe. That's what they believe. Capitalism is bad. And our economy is not going to work, as President Obama said last night. If you just have a few prospering at the expense of the middle class, we've got to have an equal plane. This article says, this is from The Spectator, it's something to be controlled, the economy, that is, at every turn by an altruistic government, or else reduced to a minimum. Meanwhile, the pursuit of equality is good. That's what the president was talking about last night. These are truly astonishing things for educated people to believe when the past 100 years have been a brutal lesson instructing us that the opposite is the case. The pursuit of equality brought the world terror and tens of millions of deaths, along with terrible economic failure. That's just been the history, the recent history, the last century. And yet, they're not taught this in colleges today. You don't get this, the reality, as part of the elite education. Far from it. And so we're cozying up to these dictators, to these tyrannical regimes, to Cuba, and trying to gloss over all the problems in Cuba, as we've covered before on this program, because there's this secret love for communism, for socialism. And so we've got to strive for all the progress we've made. We've got to go further. Here again is what the president said last night, clip 4.
There's a second threat to our democracy, and this one is as old as our nation itself. After my election, there was talk of a post-racial America. And such a vision, however well-intended, was never realistic. Race remains a potent and often divisive force in our society.
And so all the talk back in 2008 about how that having a black president for the first time in its history, that how this was going to bring the races together, all of that, he now says, was never realistic. It was never realistic. 70% of Americans back in 2008 believed that Barack Obama's presidency would help race relations. 70%. That's what we thought going in. And today it's about that same figure, 69%, that say race relations are bad. And that's the highest level since the Rodney King case back in 1992. I mean, it's so bad. I noted this a few months ago after that shooting in Dallas last year when those five police officers were gunned down. More than half of black people in a survey said that they weren't surprised by the attack. They could see why it was or why it happened. They weren't surprised. And so here is the president last night going out in much the same way that he came in. One more comment here, this again having to do with race, clip 5.
For white Americans, it means acknowledging that the effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't suddenly vanish in the 60s. That when minority groups voice discontent, they're not just engaging in reverse racism or practicing political correctness. When they wage peaceful protests, they're not demanding special treatment, but the equal treatment that our founders promised.
That's President Obama in Chicago last night, speaking before an adoring crowd, of course, and talking about race relations. And saying how to think it would get better in 2008 really wasn't very realistic. He's going out in the same way that he came in. You remember early on in his presidency when a Cambridge police officer arrested a black professor for disorderly conduct. The president then immediately sided with the professor and said that the police had acted stupidly. He went on to talk about the long history in America of African Americans and Latinos being stopped by law enforcement disproportionately. He said, that's just a fact. That's just the way it's been. Well, in that particular case, he didn't even get all the facts in the case. He just inserted himself right into the midst of it and began the attack on law enforcement. And that was a theme that would run right through his administration for 8 years. You can go right down the line with the Trayvon Martin case in 2012. If I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon, and so on. 2014 with the Michael Brown case in Ferguson, Missouri. Here again, before the case could even be heard in court, the president of the United States was out there publicly criticizing the police, accusing the police of being a bullies in all these cases. Well, it carried right on through to Freddie Gray in April 2015. The president then said some police aren't doing the right thing. And he spoke about this decades-old slow-rolling crisis. And now you look at the attacks on police. Just last year, what was it, up 10, 12%? They're on the increase. Murders. Cop killings. Over and again, he's made the problem worse. And now comes to the end of his run and says, well, it really wasn't realistic to think that things could have gotten better under my administration. But it's not his administration's fault. Here's the instructions that he gives for the whites. This is what they have to know. Black Lives Matter has a point. They have a point. Don't just say that, well, they're stirring up problems. Or don't just say that it's reverse racism. It lingers on. It was just a year and a half ago when he said it was ingrained in the DNA of white people. Racism, that is. My father in Great Again says it would be overstating it to say there's no racism among America's law enforcement officers. But there are some who are scrutinizing and magnifying this issue for evil purposes. They're using it dishonestly to explain or excuse some terrifyingly dangerous behavior. They're stirring up emotion and anger, but none of it is truly intended to solve the problem. That's what comments like last night and some of these other examples I just mentioned, that's what they're intended to do. And of course, there's a great spirit being behind it who's trying to stir up emotion and anger. There's no one out there that's really striving to solve the problem. It's just getting worse. And as we've said, it's building to the race wars discussed there in the early chapters of the book of Ezekiel. Again, that was President Obama from his farewell address last night in Chicago. Shifting gears here just a bit. One more clip from his farewell address. This is clip 6.
Our Constitution is a remarkable, beautiful gift. But it's really just a piece of parchment. It has no power on its own. We the people give it power. We the people give it meaning with our participation and with the choices that we make.
I thought that comment was interesting, particularly when you put it alongside what he said before about the Constitution and how that, as he said back in 2008, I guess it was, when he was frustrated. He was in Congress at the time, frustrated by the fact that he couldn't move things along in the agenda fast enough. And he said then that the founders made it difficult for us to bring about change. They designed a system that made it difficult for us to really make the changes as fast as we want to make them. And if you go back further, 2001, in a radio interview, Senator Obama then said that the Constitution reflected the fundamental flaw of the United States in that it was a charter of negative liberties. It tells you what you can't do, but it doesn't say what the federal government or the state government must do on your behalf. In his mind, you see, the government, the bigger it gets, the more powerful it is, the better everything will be. Bigger government. That's what they're taught. That's what's ingrained into his thinking. And then to sum it all up last night by just talking about the Constitution as a piece of parchment, of course, it is a written document, that's true. But what went into it? What was behind it? That's the thing. In Great Again, my father said America's Constitution has given more freedom to more people than any other government charter in history. He said it's a noble document that has inspired and enabled so many to attain accomplishments that any other system anywhere else in the world would have denied them. What a document. When I heard him say that in the speech, I thought of some of the things I bring out in Old Testament survey. Some of actually their verses from the New Testament. But to set up the course, we talk about how the Bible was arranged. We talk about the mind behind the Bible. Jesus said in Matthew 4 that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Every word, and those words, of course, are just on pages of your Bible, but those are God's words. And that gives those words life. Herbert Armstrong often talked about how that you have Jesus Christ, the Word, the spokesman for God, and then the Bible is that Word in print. It's Jesus Christ in print. Now, I'm not saying that the Constitution's up on the level of the Holy Bible, but if you know anything about the Bible, if you know anything about Bible prophecy, if you know anything about America's founding, if you know anything about the founding fathers, then you know there was inspiration behind that founding document. I mean, during the Constitutional Convention, when the delegates arrived at an impasse, it was Benjamin Franklin, and he certainly wasn't the most religious among them, but it was Benjamin Franklin who said, "We need to pray for the assistance of heaven. We're at an impasse here. We've got to get past this looking to God, looking to our Creator." And you can look at No Freedom Without Law and Character in Crisis, our booklets, and see one quote after another quote after another quote, where the founder said that this document was made, it was written for a moral and religious people. The president last night talked about how that, well, it's just a piece of parchment. I mean, we are the ones that give it the power. We're the ones that give the Constitution the power. It's just the opposite. Here again, it's those inspired words that give us life. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Now, they wrote in provisions that allowed for certain amendments here and there. But you've got to go back to the original source. I mean, this is a point we make over and again. In 1954, Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, he said, "I believe the entire Bill of Rights came into being because of the knowledge our forefathers had of the Bible and their belief in it." How about that? Here was a document that was based in large part on the Bible. On the Bible. My father said in No Freedom Without Law, "The Constitution is the foundation of our republic, and the Ten Commandments were in many ways the foundation of the Constitution." And so it is, in a strictly literal sense. I mean, it is words on a document. It is words on a parchment. But what about those words? What went into those words? Who was behind those words? My father went on to say here, "Our forefathers believed that if we didn't keep God's Ten Commandments, our republic would collapse." You can see why it's collapsing. Look at the all-out assault on the Constitution, on the law of the land. He says, "We cannot afford to take the words of our founders lightly if we want to see our nation stand. We can't afford to do this." And that's what's happening, of course. Taking the words of our founders lightly, saying, you know, it's an old parchment, it's an old document, and well, I'm constrained by the way that they set it up. We can't transform America quite as fast as we'd like to because of the way they drew it up from the beginning. It's a charter of negative liberties. And we've got to be released from those negative liberties so that we can impose these, what should the federal government do on your behalf? You've gotten a pretty good sampling of it over the last 8 years. Look at the healthcare program. My father says here, "The Constitution was based to a great extent on God's law. That's why I believe it is the most noble document ever written by a government of this world. The most noble document ever written." What a rare document it is. Our forefathers had an awesome opportunity to establish the rule of God in the wealthiest country ever. So they established a constitution to protect all of us from the extremes of human reason. Tyrants, unjust judges, and biased leaders were controlled by this law. There were laws drawn in, embedded into it, that prevented tyrants and unjust judges and biased leaders from carrying out their unconstitutional agendas. It's not a perfect document, but when you compare it to whatever else this world has produced. Well, going back to the way we try to set up the Old Testament survey class at Armstrong College, in talking about the way God arranged the Holy Scriptures, as they're called in 2 Timothy 3:15, Holy Scriptures that are able to make you wise unto salvation. See, it's the Scriptures. It's the original source. It's the supreme law that make you wise. That word sacred, or rather holy, it means sacred. These are sacred writings, God's Word. And then Paul goes on to say in the next verse that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. What a profit there is in these words on parchment. What a profit there is in these holy writings All Scripture is given by inspiration of God. We point out in the Old Testament survey class that that word inspiration means God breathed. It's as if God breathed these words. God is the one who wrote the Bible. He's the one who inspired all of these books, bringing them together over a course of 1,600 years. And they all perfectly complement one another. God inspired it. God organized it. God preserved it. And what a benefit. The Greek word for doctrine, by the way, in that same verse, that's 2 Timothy 3:16. It comes from another word that's also translated as instructor, master, or teacher. It's Jesus Christ in print. So as I say, I'm not putting the Constitution up on the level of the Holy Bible. But this is the most noble document. The most noble document put together by any government of this world. What a document. What a rare document it is. There's one more verse. This was 1 Timothy 4, the first book that Paul sent to Timothy, where he talked about or encouraged Timothy to be nourished up in the words of faith and of good doctrine. Be nourished on these words. Be nourished on this truth. These are the words of life. These are the words that give wisdom. These are the words that educate our lives and strengthen our faith. Well, when you look at the assault on the Constitution and just the attitude behind so many politicians, judges, and so on, you can see why this nation, the United States, is getting tripped up in so many sins, and why so many political leaders are getting caught up in one scandal after another scandal after another scandal. It gets back to lawlessness. In the program last week, I mentioned that clip, Valerie Jarrett. This was from, I guess, a week and a half ago on CNN, where she talked about how that here we are at the end of the road, and this president really does pride himself in the fact that there hasn't been a scandal. And he hasn't done anything to embarrass himself. I mean, everything's just been great. And it's just getting better. Well, I just rattled off a few off the top of my head, some of the things that we were particularly writing about back in 2012 and 2013. And then I noticed this clip from the hearings yesterday for the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is the appointment or the one that Donald Trump has nominated. And in the Senate hearings yesterday, Ted Cruz, as you'll hear here in a second, he talked about how that now that the tables have turned, you have a lot of Democrats that for 8 years, they've just been turning a blind eye to all of the lawlessness. For 8 years, this has gone on. And now, though, so many of them are coming forward saying, look, we need an attorney general who's going to uphold the law, who's going to uphold the rule of the law. All of a sudden, they're big law keepers. That's what they're now promoting. And in this clip, it's a devastating clip, really. It's just one after another after another after another of what this administration has gotten away with these past 8 years. This is clip 7.
You know, this has been an interesting day at this hearing, listening to Democratic senator after Democratic senator give speeches in praise of the rule of law. And I am heartened by that. I am encouraged by that. Because for 8 years, it's been absent. For 8 years, we've seen a Department of Justice consistently disregarding the rule of law. When Eric Holder's Department of Justice allowed illegal gun transactions, illegally sold guns to Mexican gun traffickers, as part of Fast and Furious, guns that were later used to murder Border Patrol agent Brian Terry, the Democratic members of this committee were silent. When Eric Holder was found in contempt of Congress for refusing to cooperate with Congress's investigation into Fast and Furious, once again, the Democratic members of this committee were silent. When the IRS illegally targeted United States citizens for exercising their First Amendment views, for exercising their roles in the political process, Democratic members of this committee were silent. When the Department of Justice refused to fairly investigate the IRS targeting citizens and indeed assigned the investigation to a liberal partisan Democrat who had given over $6,000 to President Obama and Democrats, Democrats on this committee were silent. When numerous members of this committee called on the Attorney General to appoint a special prosecutor to ensure that justice was done in the IRS case, Democrats on this committee were silent. When the Department of Justice used Operation Choke Point to target legal businesses because they disagreed politically with those businesses, the Democrats on this committee were silent. When the Obama Justice Department sent millions of dollars of taxpayer monies to sanctuary cities that were defying federal immigration law, the Democrats on this committee were silent. When the Obama administration refused to enforce federal immigration laws and unilaterally rewrote those laws, the Democrats on this committee were silent. When the Obama administration released tens of thousands of criminal illegal aliens, including rapists and murderers, into the general population, Democrats on this committee were silent. When the Department of Justice signed off on the Obama administration paying a nearly $2 billion ransom to Iran, contrary to federal law, the Democrats on this committee were silent. When the Obama administration ignored and rewrote provision after provision of Obamacare, contrary to the text of the law, the Democrats on this committee were silent. When the Obama administration signed off on illegal recess appointments that the Supreme Court had to strike down unanimously, the Democrats on this committee were silent. And when the Obama administration released five Guantanamo terrorists without the required notification of Congress, the Democrats on this committee were silent. That pattern has been dismaying for 8 years, but I take today as a moment of celebration. If once again this committee has a bipartisan commitment to rule of law, to following the law, that is a wonderful thing, and it is consistent with the tradition of this committee going back centuries.
That's Ted Cruz from the Senate hearings yesterday for Jeff Sessions becoming Attorney General. We had to edit the middle of it, by the way, because it was interrupted by some protesters that are convinced that Jeff Sessions is a horrible individual. But what a speech there. What a speech. And devastating, as I say. It's one after another. And that's what happens when you have an administration come in that views the Constitution as a charter of just negative liberties only. And that's its fundamental flaw. That's its fundamental flaw. I mean, we're not going to be able to radically transform things with these kinds of negative liberties. And then to top it off, last night, you have him talking about it as being just a piece of parchment, has no power of its own. But we, the people, we have the power. Yes, we can. That's how he concluded his speech. Yes, we did. To close the loop on the speech during the night that he was elected and all the euphoria, we're going to fundamentally transform the United States, and that's been done. America Under Attack and Great Again. I mean, read those two books. And you see just how successful this administration has been in bringing about this fundamental transformation. And the thing is, as Great Again brings out, a new administration's not going to reverse all of this. It's not going to make things better. Because at its core, I mean, look at the root cause of the problem here, lawlessness. And maybe there will be some short-term positives from an attorney general if Mr. Sessions gets in there that's going to support the police and uphold the rule of law, much more so than his predecessors. But still, as you know where the direction, where this is headed. And more important still, you know the spirit that's behind what's been happening to the United States. As my father wrote, I quoted this on Friday, as these scandals pile higher and higher, this is from an article in 2013, nobody can get administration officials to tell them anything. They've lied and lied and lied, and they've been caught in their lies. And then he went on to talk about how they cloaked it in a, or rather they covered their lies in a cloak of deceit. But then he says there's a spiritual dimension behind this. That's what we need to see. Satan has been cast down. We keep referring you back to Revelation 12 and the fact that he's confined to this earth. That's the cause. Satan himself is a lawless being. Satan himself opposes God at every turn. He hates God's law. He hates that original document. He hates the source of life. He hates those precious words of life. But Satan will not be ruling on this earth forever. He knows, as Revelation 12 says, he knows his time is about up. He knows his time is short. And that's why he's filled with so much wrath and hatred. And that's why you see his fingerprints on so many things in this world today. When we come back, we'll shift gears a bit and take you over to Germany and this piece from a National Review that I mentioned at the top of the show. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
And some of us, my friends, know not only what we see when we're over there, but we know also what is prophesied. And we know what is prophesied to rise up in Europe. And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
Its heart is in Germany. That's Herbert Armstrong from one of his old radio programs. We've played that clip for you before. But it's a good lead-in to this piece by Jay Nordlinger at National Review about Germany, Japan, and their militaries. It's a two-part series, the first part being about Germany specifically. Germany's military. This is from January 10th. It says Germany and Japan have not been known for military forays since 1945. Much of the world has liked it that way. So have many Germans and Japanese. But a new era is upon us. Germany and Japan are venturing out. They are rethinking their military postures. After 70 years, this was perhaps inevitable. In any case, it is so. Well, the Bible says it. It says it would happen. God inspired those prophecies in Revelation 17, in Revelation 13, in Daniel 2, in Daniel 7, in Daniel 8. God inspired those prophecies thousands of years ago. 2,000, almost 3,000 years ago, in some cases. Here they are now, rethinking their military postures. It says the Germans are sending a battalion to the Baltic states, specifically to Lithuania. Japan is sending troops to South Sudan under new, indeed historic, rules of engagement. They may use force not only to defend themselves, but to defend others. More broadly, Germany and Japan are responding to new threats. They are also responding to a new America, which is ready to abandon or lighten the burdens it has long carried. We have a new America on the scene. We have a new Germany. We have a new Japan. And then he says here, and you'll recognize some of these quotes you're about to hear, not everyone was happy about the reunification of Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall. It says prominent among them, or prominent among the unhappy, was Margaret Thatcher, who said, with alarm, we beat the Germans twice, and now they're back. Now they're back. Her fellow Briton, General Ismay, had made a famous remark. He was the first Secretary General of NATO, and he described the alliance's purpose as to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. And so what happens when the Americans move out and the Russians start pushing their way in and the Germans start rethinking their military strategy and the Germans start rethinking their military postures? It's astounding, really, that there aren't more people that see what's happening. It's an excellent article here, an excellent article. But I'm sure it's not sending off or sounding off alarm bells anywhere. It's just another, oh, this is now happening. This is part of the new world order. And then in the next installment, I'll talk about Japan a little bit more. And this is just the way it is. And really, the most astounding of all is that more of God's own people aren't awake to what's happening. So many Laodicean brethren that have just gone to sleep, even as these prophecies are being fulfilled. It was Herbert Armstrong who, back in 1945, I mean, well, how did he start his article here? They haven't known any or gotten into any military forays since 1945. And what was Mr. Armstrong saying in 1945? After Germany had been ruined, buried under rubble, he said, the war is over in Europe, or is it? We need to wake up and realize that right now is the most dangerous moment in the United States or in United States national history. Instead of assuming we now have peace. Well, that's what he warned 70 years ago. He went on to say, we don't understand German thoroughness. From the very start of World War II, they have considered the possibility of losing this second round, as they did the first, and they have carefully, methodically planned in such eventuality the third round, World War III. God inspired that warning because it was based on that founding document, the Holy Bible, the Holy Scriptures, inspired by God. And Mr. Armstrong opened the book, he peered into it, And he believed. He believed there was authority behind this document. There was authority behind these words. There was life. Living words, as it says in the Gospels. He said further, this round of war in Europe is over and the Nazis have gone underground. In France and Norway, they learned how effectively an organized underground can hamper occupation and control of a country. And he said later, this is from 1945, they plan to come back. They plan to come back and win on the third try. Yes, and so what happens when the Americans leave Europe? And when the Russians start threatening from the east? And then the Germans are no longer down and out. What happens? What happens is history repeats itself. What happens is Bible prophecy is fulfilled. Back to this Nordlinger piece, it says, eventually many people decided that Germany had been down long enough. Radek Sikorsky, here's another statement you'll recognize, made a famous statement of his own when he was foreign minister of Poland. The year was 2011, and he was speaking in Berlin. I will probably be the first Polish foreign minister in history to say so, but here it is. I fear German power less that I'm beginning to fear German inactivity. You have become Europe's indispensable nation. That was Poland. That was a foreign minister from Poland in 2011, urging Germany to take the lead. Urging Germany to be more powerful, more assertive as the indispensable nation of Europe. Well, in this article, he goes on to say how that for the longest time, of course, America saw itself as the indispensable nation. And then he touches on these past 8 years under President Obama, who made it clear his distaste for free riders. Other nations need to pay their own way. They need to pay for their own defense. Going back to Sikorsky, this Polish foreign minister, the blunt reality is that there will be dwindling appetite and patience in the U.S. Congress and in the American body politic writ large to expend increasingly precious funds on behalf of nations that are apparently unwilling to devote the necessary resources or make the necessary changes to be serious and capable partners in their own defense. In other words, the U.S. is in retreat abroad and amassing all of this power at home, the U.S. government, and going into debt. All the more, it says, of late, Germany has not been exactly a wallflower on the international scene. They are part of the Afghan coalition, of course. That war is a NATO operation, among other things. The Germans have been in Africa, in Mali, for example, and they're planning to build an outpost in Niger. This is all with an eye to counterterrorism. And they've been arming and training Kurds in the fight against ISIS. But it's Russia that has really concentrated the German mind. What's happening in Russia? Here again, going back to that famous quote by General Ismay of Britain, describing NATO as, well, we've got to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. That's the purpose here. The Americans are on the way out. I mean, a President Trump administration is only going to continue with what we've seen in these past 8 years, maybe with a few tweaks here and there, but the same general foreign policy. Look, we're no more free riders. You've got to look after yourself now. Further on in this article, I'm not going to have time to get through all of it, it looks like, or to the emails for that matter. We'll have to save some of this for another time. But it says here, the Lithuanian president, this is, I believe, a woman that I can't pronounce. She said this, I think we are at a historic turning point. First, a lot of time has passed, and a breakthrough is occurring in the German mindset. Time for self-doubt, fear, reluctance to take responsibility, and dread of what Putin might think is over. I mean, that time is over. Further on, it says, Germany has embarked on a tremendous military expansion. This is the National Review. Billions more euros, thousands more soldiers. What we're seeing is a tremendous military expansion in Germany. And who told you first about this happening? About this history repeating itself? About this prophecy being fulfilled? Well, you can go all the way back to 1945 and those statements by Herbert W. Armstrong coming out of World War II. And now we're seeing these prophecies, these Bible prophecies written on pages of parchment. We're seeing them come to life right before our eyes. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We have more material. We'll have to get to it tomorrow. Sorry about that. But thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you soon.